With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And in this episode, I'm going to be talking a bit about Operation Sea Lion, the planned invasion of Britain by Nazi Germany, and the reasons why the operation was finally scrapped and indefinitely postponed, and its relationship with the ongoing Battle of Britain. Now, if you're a regular listener, you'll know that I've been looking at the summer of 1940 for the last few weeks from a number of different perspectives, British, German, French and American. And we're going to gradually move on and look at the war as it unfolds, phase by phase. But I think that this period of time is so important, because between the summer of 1940 and, I guess, the winter of 1941, the fate of Nazi Germany particularly, I believe, is decided in a number of what Ian Kershaw describes as fateful decisions. But I won't be drawing from Ian Kershaw today. I'll be looking at Anthony Beevor's history of the Second World War, which as a general reader is second to none, really, as a modern exploration of the war. Really, should be in the kind of the arsenal of every history enthusiast and student. Following the signing of the armistice between France and Germany in the train carriage in Compiègne Forest, where the original armistice in 1918 was signed, Hitler, in a moment of triumphalism, describes it as the greatest victory in world history. And the bells are rung across Germany, and Hitler allows himself a little tour in the early light of Paris, along with his favourite architect, Arno Breker. And he looked at Paris, and he was toying with the idea of having Paris razed to the ground. And then he thought, in typical vanity, that this wasn't necessary, that Paris would simply wither away once Hitler's new planned capital, Germania, was built, which would dwarf Paris. However, Hitler, when he returns to the Anhalter station in Berlin by train, is greeted by cheering crowds and adulation. And his popularity levels, even among non-Nazis, even among sceptics, even among former Social Democrats, leaps to almost unimaginable levels. And this is probably the one moment in Hitler's career where he was genuinely, universally popular across Germany. The popular sentiment was either one of awe and disbelief at the scale of the victory, or, from more cautious observers, a grudging admiration that he had actually pulled it off, and despite everything else, he'd managed to do in 6 weeks what the Kaiser had failed to do in 4 years. However, there's a gnawing doubt in the back of Hitler's mind. Hitler had assumed that the British would already have approached Germany for peace terms long before now. But Britain's first act was the destruction of the French fleet at Oran. And you can catch that on the podcast I did on the consequences of Dunkirk. Apocryphally, the French General Hunziker, who signed the armistice, said that the armistice would only have any value for France if Britain was to follow suit within the next 12 weeks. Otherwise, they had the signatories, the French signatories, would have committed an almighty crime against France itself. The reasoning in France, Vichy France and Germany, was that Britain would realise its hopelessness and would never be able to hold out alone, and that Churchill would be quickly overthrown and deposed by a united peace party or an armistice party in the House of Commons. One of Hitler's main handicaps was Joachim von Ribbentrop. Ribbentrop, his star had rather fallen by this point. However, he had for years fed wildly misleading reports about the workings of British political life back to Hitler in the 1930s on his various visits to Britain as Hitler's representative and then ambassador. He informed Hitler that the House of Commons had no power anyway, and that the country was run by 200 aristocratic families who made things happen. This is all guesswork by Ribbentrop, and wildly misleading guesswork at that. So it gives you a flavour of Hitler's misunderstanding and confusion about British intentions in the summer of 1940. Hitler had to consider what to do and what move to make next, and particularly what to do about Great Britain. He thought about possible strategies for a few days, and then discussed with his commanders-in-chief and issued Directive No. 16 for the preparations of a landing operation against England. The impression that one gets from this is that it is a decision taken in haste, based on poor information, and one which doesn't really address the real priorities of Hitler's war and what Hitler's actual war aims were. Really, it was to finally deal with the last remaining nuisance in the West before the real business of conquering the East occurs. But it also tells us that in the few days between Hitler's return and the issuing of Directive 16, that the belief that Britain would come to terms must have evaporated from Hitler's mind. There was already a working plan in place. The Study Nordwest, which had been completed in the December of 1939. The Kriegsmarine's losses in Norway led Admiral Raeder to insist that an invasion couldn't happen by sea alone, and it could only happen if the air superiority using the Luftwaffe had been achieved over England in the first place. The army, represented by Franz Halder, is a lot more cautious and tell Hitler that invasion should only be the last resort, and it needed to be very well planned and given a great deal of attention. But the task rested upon the Kriegsmarine, the German Navy, and there was such a shortage of ships and craft to take 100,000 men, the first wave of invasion, across the Channel, along with enough tanks, vehicles, lorries, staff cars, armoured cars, motorcycles and all the works. And the naval escort force that would accompany in it would be no match for the Royal Navy. Given the fact that autumn was heading soon and the window between the calm seas of the summer months and the choppier waters of the autumn and winter was rapidly closing, so there wasn't really the time to do the operation in. The real enthusiasts for the operation are the SS, the Gestapo, and the SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, the security department of the SS. Walter Schellenberg, the SS spymaster, had a list of everyone from George Orwell through to Winston Churchill, who was to be arrested and no doubt executed. 2,820 individuals who were going to be seized during and after the invasion. Hitler knew enough to know that the disintegration of the British Empire, which would happen almost automatically, Britain fell with Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the Dominions, India, and large portions of Africa declaring their independence from a fascist Britain, which would have been created by Hitler, putting Oswald Mosley in number 10 and Edward VIII on the throne, would lead to a serious international destabilisation, and powers like America, Japan and the Soviet Union would quickly seize the colonies that the British had abandoned or that had decided to proclaim their independence. This in turn would pour resources into the hands of future targets like the Soviet Union and possible adversaries like the USA. It would give the Japanese opportunities that Hitler had not previously considered and change the strategic picture of the world in ways that Hitler hadn't bargained for. So he was aware that a disintegration of the British Empire could actually cause all sorts of unintended and unforeseen problems. And another figure in Hitler's arsenal of advisers who was feeding him all manner of misleading reports was, of course, Hermann Göring, the new Reich Marshal, who was head of the Luftwaffe and who claimed that Britain could be defeated from the air within a relatively short time period. But one glance at the Luftwaffe would have told, and even a casual observer, that this wasn't true. The Luftwaffe wasn't prepared for this kind of operation. The belief that Göring had was that the British were going to capitulate anyway. And so there wasn't much of a time after the Battle of France to re-equip squadrons and repurpose them for a different kind of aerial campaign. The Luftwaffe, Stuka dive bombers and Heinkel dive bombers were ideal for strafing columns of civilians. They were ideal for attacking British soldiers on the beaches of Dunkirk. And they were ideal for terror attacks on fortress cities such as Sedan. For heavy, long-term bombing campaigns on British airfields, infrastructure, and the Dowding radar system, they're not that useful. Because dive bombers are quite slow and would find themselves flying in probably the best defended part of airspace in the world. In the Battle of France, the British had lost 930 aircraft. The Germans had lost 1,284. The adoption of airfields in northern France, which put the Luftwaffe in range of Great Britain, was a much more prolonged and drawn-out affair than had previously been considered. Not only does everything seem to be done at the beginnings of the Battle of Britain in a very kind of chaotic way, far more chaotic than the kind of the popular myth of Nazi efficiency, which is really quite a myth, would allow us to believe, but also it just suggests that it's really not a key priority. And as I previously mentioned on the other podcast, later on, veterans of the Battle of Britain, German veterans of the Battle of Britain, all attest to the fact that it was widely seen as something of a sideshow.
1-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Not really one of the more important air campaigns of the war. And in July 1940, the focus of the Luftwaffe isn't even on actual mainland Britain. It's on destroying shipping in the Channel and the Thames estuary. This was referred to as the Canal Kampf, the Channel War, and mainly Stuka bombers and accompanied by torpedo boats shut down the English Channel, preventing any shipping from making it. And this is why you find along the western coast of Great Britain, from Liverpool down to, Glasgow, Liverpool, some of the Welsh ports, Cardiff and Swansea, Bristol and the like, become the nerve centres of British shipping. One of the most bombed parts of the UK is Western Approaches in Liverpool, the nerve centre of the British Maritime Fleet. These were the only conduits into Britain because it was impossible also to use eastern ports on the North Sea. They become of primary importance of keeping the country going during the war. And obviously they are major targets for bombing, as cities like Bristol and Swansea and Cardiff can attest to. One thing that Hitler clearly didn't understand, and he makes a speech on the 19th of July to the Kroll Opera House, which shows his lack of understanding, is that Churchill was now an unassailable figure in British politics following the evacuation at Dunkirk and his speeches to the House. But he also didn't understand that Churchill couldn't moderate his stance even if he wanted to. For Churchill, this would have been political suicide. The idea that he had rallied the nation and then was prepared to compromise. So there was no possibility, even though Hitler makes his final speech on the 19th of July, asking for an appeal to reason and becoming intensely frustrated with the intransigence of the British, he misunderstands really what dynamics are going on within British society. The British, for their part, took the threat of invasion extremely seriously. Most of the equipment of the British Expeditionary Force had been abandoned on the beaches of Dunkirk, and as we've already seen in previous podcasts, Churchill appealed directly to Roosevelt to help, essentially saying, demanding assistance as opposed to asking for it. Churchill tapped into a narrative that existed within sort of British historical discourses about how Britain tends to be the underdog at the start of any conflict, and this was certainly true with Napoleonic Wars, but at the end the British would have their day. It was unclear to most people how this would happen. But to Churchill, from 1940 onwards, it was abundantly clear that it would be with American help. It seems that one of the main worries that the chiefs of staff, the British chiefs of staff, had was the defence of aircraft factories. The RAF was dependent on new aircraft. So they'd lost 136 pilots in France and had 700 planes ready to fly in the Battle of Britain. But it was the productive capacity of Britain that's really the key to understanding the Battle of Britain. The British could produce nearly 500 new aircraft a month, and this was almost double the amount of aircraft that the Germans could produce. The British, short on manpower, could call from their dominions and colonies for aviators, Canadian, Australian, New Zealand, South African, Indian, West Indian pilots and air crew came to fight in Britain. And let's obviously not forget the Poles and the Czechs and the French, Dutch and Belgian aviators who also crossed the Channel, escaped, and Norwegian and Danish as well. Experienced pilots were worth their weight in gold. The freshly trained pilot was the one most likely to be shot down. And the Poles bring 8,000 Air Force personnel following the fall of Poland. They were men with combat experience, and the cultural and the strategic integration with the RAF is very slow and postponed. The Poles under General Sikorsky demanded an independent Polish Air Force, but the RAF veto this, and they bring instead the Poles into the RAF Volunteer Reserve, and they suddenly are the more conservative, with a small c, British pilots who are used to flying in fixed formations suddenly realise that the Poles are extraordinary pilots. Their unorthodox attitude, their sheer determination and bravery, and their refusal really to listen to senior British commanders earn them the kind of the title of being the crazy Poles. And of course they are powered on by revenge and relish the opportunity to take on the Luftwaffe over the South Downs of Great Britain. But there are all sorts of memoirs that you can find from the various Polish veterans associations across Great Britain of a deep affection that the British had for the Poles, and vice versa. The huge excitement that British people had on seeing the Poles arrive, and the camaraderie and friendship and the admiration that Poles were fighting to keep Britain free, and also, you know, in the long term, fighting to regain their own country. So there was a great deal of solidarity there. And the contribution of Polish fighters to Great Britain's freedom, sadly forgotten these days, really does bear remembering. At the height of the Battle of Britain, one in every 10 pilots in the southeast of England, where most of the fighting was done, were Polish. And on the 13th of July, the first Polish squadron of pilots was formed, and within a month, the British allowed General Sikorsky to establish the Polish Air Force with its own fighter and bomber squadrons under RAF command. Hitler sensed that Churchill was waiting for the Soviet Union to go to war with Nazi Germany. On the 31st of July, he summons a meeting at the Berghof with his generals, and he begins to discuss the invasion of the Soviet Union. He begins to say that it is only through the destruction of the Soviet Union that the British will realise that they are completely alone and completely defeated, and that nobody is coming to their rescue. He said, "With Russia smashed, Britain's last hope would be shattered. Germany will then be master of Europe and the Balkans." Now, it's important not to overstate the importance of this in terms of Hitler's decisions for invading the Soviet Union. These were long-considered plans, and the idea that Hitler simply wanted to invade the Soviet Union in order to break Britain, I don't think makes complete sense, but I do think it is a contributory factor. Now, as we go on in the next few weeks, we'll get closer to Barbarossa and we'll discuss it in more depth then. The timing for Britain certainly seems right at the end of July. Goering assumes it will take a matter of weeks. The morale of the Luftwaffe is high following the defeat of France. The numerical superiority before manufacturing is factored in seems to be going in the direction of the Luftwaffe. Just to have a look at some of the stats here. In France, there are 656 Messerschmitt Me-109s, 168 Me-110 twin-engined fighters, 769 Dornier, Heinkel and Junkers 88 bombers, and 316 Stuka dive bombers. against 504 Hurricanes and Spitfires commanded by Hugh Dowding. By this point, already probing attacks on British airfields and fighters had taken place to see how quickly it would be possible to wear down the RAF in the skies. And British fighters had been called up to defend airspaces and defend coastal radar stations. Radar stations and the Observer Corps across Britain, along with communications networks, buried telephone lines, command centres, the Dowding system in essence, which I hope to talk about in a separate podcast, meant that the British were extraordinarily efficient in getting aircraft to the enemy, that there didn't have to be a long period of time in the RAF getting into the air and doing long patrols along the coast and the channel. Getting fighters into the air quickly to save on fuel and getting them up to combat altitude meant that the fighters could be there for longer. And this was one of the key distinctions, one of the key game changers for the British in the Battle of Britain. The Luftwaffe couldn't be in British airspace for long enough because they had to fly from France. Hugh Dowding, the Air Chief Marshal and commander of the RAF, had built the complex Dowding system of command centres and communications before the war, and he had also made the decision to hold back Spitfire squadrons during the Battle of France. And this obviously doesn't include the Battle of Dunkirk, but he didn't want most of the RAF stationed in France for the airfields to be overrun and the aircrews to be captured or killed and the planes to be destroyed. He fell foul of Churchill on this score, and Churchill was determined to destroy Dowding as soon as possible in a typical Churchillian vindictiveness. However, it transpires that Dowding's decision was absolutely correct, and both Dowding and Air Marshal Keith Park, who was the commander of 11 Group, which was going to defend the most important part of sector, London and the South East, were able to listen to their aircrews to get feedback on what it is the aircrews needed, and this normally meant the aircrews wanted the old hidebound tactics and doctrines of the RAF to be disbanded for more flexible approaches to dealing with the enemy. Now, in the next podcast on this topic, we're going to look at the Eagle Day, the Adlertag, which was the first day of the offensive against Great Britain. And we'll continue this in the next couple of hours. Thanks very much, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Do remember to give us a good thumbs up on iTunes, and if you can, check out our Patreon page, and if you can sponsor us, that would be grand. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.